Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Tension prevails in Belgium during the third day of lockdown. Belgian prosecutors said Monday that anti-terrorism raids have resulted in five more arrests, bringing the total to 21, as the capital of Brussels remains on the highest level of alert. Brussels' subway system and its schools are closed today as wary residents face a third day of a lockdown. European Union Commission President Donald Tusk.
I deeply believe that terrorists will not intimidate us, and because in fact, freedom and solidarity is much stronger than fear and violence. It's also our political obligation to be together against this dramatic challenge, maybe the biggest one in our times.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. Malian authorities are continuing their search for at least three suspects they believe are connected to Friday's deadly jihadist attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel in the capital of Bamako that killed 19 people. A representative from Northern Mali separatist group said the assault on the hotel was an attempt to derail its fragile peace accord that was signed back in June. An Israeli army said a Palestinian attacker stabbed two Israelis at a gas station on the edge of the West Bank today, killing one of them before being shot dead. The incident has prompted new security measures announced by Israel's prime minister. The killing follows a separate attack earlier in the day when Israeli police shot dead a Palestinian teenager and wounded a second teenage girl Monday in Jerusalem after they stabbed a man with scissors. Now, the victim in that attack was a 70-year-old Palestinian the teens apparently mistook for an Israeli. This is VOA News.
This sometime I wish to encounter all the people of Kenya and Uganda and to offer everyone a word of encouragement.
That, of course, Pope Francis addressing the people of Kenya and Uganda as he readies for his African visit.
We are living at a time when religious believers and persons of good will everywhere are called to foster mutual understanding and respect.
Pope Francis is to begin his first official visit to Africa Wednesday in Kenya. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Streets are being paved, banners have been hung by the highways, and Pope Francis-branded merchandise is for sale. All to welcome the pontiff when he kicks off his Africa tour in Kenya. Kennedy Agesa is a tailor living in the Nairobi slum of Kangemi.
We heard the rumors Pope is coming. We are very happy.
Advocating for the poor has been a key tenet of his papacy. Father Simon Peter Kemomoi is a priest at Nairobi's Holy Family Minor Basilica.
So when they see the Holy Father now living a very simple life, you know, he is now identifying with the poor.
Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Now, the Pope will be spending 3 days in Kenya before moving on to his next destination. As winter approaches in Afghanistan, the Taliban offensive continues. The ongoing hostilities, coupled with deepening economic troubles, unemployment estimated at around 24%, and governance issues, have brought President Ashraf Ghani's government under mounting opposition and public pressure. Ayaz Ghul reports from VOA's South Asia Bureau in Islamabad.
Taliban insurgents continue to stage battlefield assaults on Afghan security forces and temporarily seize territory, particularly in northern Afghanistan, where the onset of winter traditionally causes a slowdown in the fighting. The Islamist insurgency has expanded its activities in northern Afghanistan, particularly after it briefly captured the strategically important city of Kunduz in September. Interior Ministry spokesman Siddiq Siddiqui says Afghan forces have launched an operation to evict the insurgents, promising good results very soon. He says that the government is determined to evict the insurgents from the Yamgan district and inflict heavy casualties on the enemy to deter future Taliban attacks in the north. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Security operations are also being planned to flush out insurgents from other areas, including the major poppy-producing southern Helmand province. This is Joe Palca, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
When armed gunmen barged into the Reds and Blue in Bamako last week, it was not just an attack on a luxurious hotel in the Malian capital. The target the attackers choose symbolizes regional and international interests in Mali, a move that threatens foreign investments, stability and peace.
That's Katerina Hoya reporting. Details coming up also in the news. Anti-terrorism raids have resulted in 5 more arrests, bringing the total to 21, as Belgium's capital Brussels remains on the highest level of alert. And a panel of health experts say the World Health Organization's slow response to the Ebola crisis was an egregious failure. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, President Obama issued an executive order today declaring a national emergency with respect to the political turmoil and violence in Burundi. The executive order says the situation in Burundi poses an extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States. It's aimed at activists by individuals within the government and armed groups that contribute to the turmoil there, including threats to peace and security, actions that undermine democratic institutions, and human rights abuses. The president imposed sanctions on 4 individuals, including the Minister of Public Security, the Deputy Director General of the National Police, a former Burundi intelligence chief, and a former Minister of Defense. They will have their property and interests in the United States blocked or frozen. Also, U.S. citizens are prohibited from doing business with them. Mr. Obama's executive order also imposes visa restrictions. Mali began 3 days of mourning today to remember those who died in last Friday's terrorist attack. When armed gunmen barged into the Radisson Blue in Bamako, it was not just an attack on a luxurious hotel in the Malian capital. Katerina Hoya reports for VOA that the target symbolizes regional and international interests in Mali, a move that threatens foreign investments, stability and peace.
Radisson Blue was considered one of the safest hotels in Bamako. Among its guests were diplomats, presidents and foreign businessmen looking to invest in Mali. At the time of the attack, a group of Chinese investors from the China Railway Company building the railway from Bamako to Dakar was staying at the hotel. The flight staff from Air France and Turkish Airlines was also there. Political analyst Issa Ndiaye says there are many reasons why the hotel was targeted.
C'est un concentré d'endroits où...
The Radisson was the perfect target for multiple reasons, one being the many foreigners that frequently stay at hotel and the ISIS. The Radisson is where international investors meet and business deals are signed.
L'attaque du Radisson, ça va dire que ceux qui veulent venir vont réfléchir à plusieurs fois.
And the ISIS says the attack will have foreign investors think twice before they invest in Mali. 2 West African militant groups, Al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb, Akim and his affiliate Al-Murabitun claim joint responsibility for the attack. Al-Murabitun, the creation of former Al-Qaeda leader Mokhtar Mokhtar, took to Twitter and called the attack an act against Mali and France. The group claimed a similar attack on a hotel in Sèvres, a garrison town a couple of 100 kilometers north of Bamako. 17 people were killed in the August attack on that hotel, which was frequented by staff with the United Nations mission in Mali. While Al-Murabitun has the capacity to commit such an attack, most analysts in Mali point to another Islamist extremist group. Ansar Dine, headed by prominent Tuareg Yad Agagali, has recently expanded its territory by cooperating with the Messina Liberation Movement, active in the country's center and south. The United States and France consider Ansar Dine a terrorist movement. It has close ties with Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, Akim, and was excluded from the peace negotiations between the government and northern rebel groups. Behind the group's radical Islam that would impose Sharia law in all of Mali, our political and financial interests, says Professor Hamidoun Magassa, who studies Islam and terrorism in Mali. He says group leader Yad has been involved in every rebellion in Mali since the 1980s. He is an influential voice in the north, and behind him you have Akim, which in fact controls all the extremist groups, Magasa adds. The attack was a power demonstration by the attackers and its allies, says Issa Ndiaye. He fears more attacks will follow. This was the second attack in Bamako targeting Western interests by Islamist extremists this year. In March, an attack at a restaurant in Hippodrome, a neighborhood where many NGOs and foreign businesses have their offices, killed 5 people. Katrina Höye for VOA News in Bamako.
Belgian prosecutors say anti-terrorism raids have resulted in 5 more arrests, bringing the total to 21, but the capital, Brussels, remains on the highest level of alert. Earlier today, prosecutors said police have arrested 16 terror suspects in 22 raids. 19 of the raids were in location in and around Brussels. Prosecutors said at least one suspect was wounded. However, top Paris massacre suspect Salah Abdeslam still remains at large. Abdeslam is thought to have crossed into Belgium November 14th, just hours after Islamic State gunmen killed 130 people and wounded hundreds of others in Paris. Brussels' subway system and its schools are closed today as residents face a third day of lockdown and another work week overshadowed by the massive manhunt. In Paris later yesterday, heavily armed security forces patrolled largely empty streets. French President François Hollande will meet tomorrow with President Obama as part of a multi-nation tour to spur action against Islamic State militants and push for a political settlement to Syria's civil war. The White House said the two leaders will discuss further cooperation as part of the U.S.-led coalition that has been conducting airstrikes against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria for more than a year. French warplanes have been part of the effort. Hollande said today his military will intensify its Syria strikes. Also, France sponsored a U.N. Security Council resolution passed last week that urges all able countries to work to prevent and suppress terrorist acts by Islamic State and other groups and to eradicate their safe haven in eastern Syria and northern and western sections of Iraq. Before leaving France for his meeting with Obama, Hollande today hosted British Prime Minister David Cameron, who said he plans to ask his parliament this week to approve expanding Britain's involvement in the US-led coalition to include airstrikes in Syria. Turkey's state-run news agency says authorities have recovered the body of a 4-year-old girl who was among a group of 10 migrants reported missing after a boat sank on November 18th. The Anadolu agency says the girl's body was discovered yesterday among rocks in the resort of Bodrum on the Aegean. Save the Children says more than 70 children have drowned trying to reach Greece since September. Migrants barred from crossing from Greece into Macedonia held a fourth day of protest yesterday. Macedonia's president says the risk of conflict between refugees, police and residents is increasing. 6 Iranian migrants have sewn their mouths shut during a protest near the village of Idomina at the Greek-Macedonia border. They took the action today as several hundred migrants, many from Iran and Morocco, protested. Some blocked rail traffic and demanded passage. The number of migrants being barred from entering Macedonia has fallen from more than 2,000 to around 1,300 in the early evening. Many of them took buses and taxis to Athens and Thessaloniki. Greek police believe they may be trying to find other routes, including with the help of smugglers. Meanwhile, in Kabul, the AP says a man admits to forging letters threatening a death sentence, and he sells the documents to Afghans fleeing the country. Some forgers charge as much as $1,000. The threats are printed on stationery with the so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and allege the bearer of the letter has worked for the U.S. government or Afghan security forces. Meanwhile, in Egypt's North Sinai, security forces say at least five Sudanese migrants were shot dead along Egypt's border with Israel today. It was not clear who shot the migrants. Another 11 migrants were wounded by what the security sources said were gunmen. The region is the center of Islamist militant attacks on Egyptian government forces. Save the Children is one of the many humanitarian organizations helping the thousands of migrants and refugees in Europe. Dorothy Sang is the aid group's humanitarian communications officer in Croatia. She is currently at the border with Serbia. From the eastern town of Slavonski Brod, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa about the refugee flow.
We've been really surprised just the rate at which people are continuing to come over. We're still seeing around 5,000, 6,000 people come through a day. I think on Thursday it peaked at about 9,000. And as you can imagine, it's getting pretty cold here. So people are coming through with various needs. We have lots of babies who are having respiratory problems, probably because they don't have enough clothing. I mean, by the time people get to us here in Croatia, they've been on the road for quite some time. And lots of people don't have the basics like warm clothing, socks for babies. Often mothers won't have had a chance to stop to breastfeed or anything like that. So by the time they get to us, yeah, there's a lot of needs.
Can you describe what security is like on the border?
The way it works here in Croatia is that they're on a train straight from Serbia into the camp. Just a few weeks ago, it was a different scenario where we had people who were walking to a place called Bapska, which was on the border with Serbia, and it was quite chaotic and often very difficult to manage. But as this crisis is continuing, you're seeing efforts from governments in the Balkan region to coordinate a bit better. So there isn't the kind of scenes that you might have been seeing on the news of people piled up at the border, although now that we're seeing that they're limiting who is coming through based on nationality, I believe that we are concerned that some people are going to get trapped.
Which people do you think might get trapped?
Well, at the moment, what we understand is that governments are saying that they will only be accepting people who are from Syria, from Afghanistan, or from Iraq. And there's a far broader makeup of people who are coming through. We've seen people from African countries such as Somalia, Sudan, to other places in the Middle East, and then North Africa like Morocco and Iran as well. And so we're really concerned about them, particularly if children are being turned back, because we don't know where they're going to be sent back to. And I'm not sure that there's anything in train to help these people.
Some countries have said they would no longer accept economic migrants. Are you seeing that?
Well, it's very difficult for them to determine who is an economic migrant just based on where they're coming from. The whole point behind claiming asylum is that they're taken on an individual case-by-case basis. So we're quite worried that this idea that you can determine who is an economic migrant and who is deserving of asylum just based on the country that they come from isn't really in keeping with the UN Convention.
Have you seen any tighter security since the Paris attacks?
What we've seen is that actually the biggest impact seems to be on the refugees themselves. They're very concerned about the image that's being portrayed of them. And also what we have to understand is that this shouldn't harden our hearts towards refugees, because they're escaping the horrors that we saw in Paris. And so really now is the time to be thinking about how we can help refugees en route and at home.
Now, the refugees and migrants who are in Croatia, how long do they usually stay there? And if they don't stay there, what country are they trying to get to?
The way that it works here is it's very much a transit camp. So nobody really stays here for very long. They get on a train from Serbia. They get registered in Croatia. They might stay in the camp for, I'd say the average time's around 6 hours. And then when they go on from there, they get onto a train that takes them to Slovenia.
So it sounds like things are relatively peaceful in Croatia regarding the migrants and refugees.
I wouldn't say totally peaceful in that sense. I mean, it's terribly, terribly cold, and people are really quite in desperate situation when they get to us. And luckily that we've got some services here that are available to them. But it's been a very traumatic journey for many people, and lots of people are running away from things equally as harrowing. I mean, as far as the security situation, sure, but the situation that refugees are in themselves is definitely far from peaceful.
Dorothy Sang is with the humanitarian organization Save the Children from the eastern Croatian town of Slavonski Brod. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Anti-terrorism raids have resulted in five more arrests, bringing the total to 21 as Belgium's capital Brussels remains on the highest level of alert. And Mali began 3 days of mourning today to remember those who died in last Friday's terrorist attack. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Hundreds of trucks traveling the transnational highway from Bamenda, Cameroon to Enugu, Nigeria, are parked in Cameroon by drivers protesting what they call illegal harassment and extortion by Cameroon authorities. The drivers say several of their leaders have been arrested. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Tambe Eno, an official of the truck drivers union, says some of their members were arrested while protesting what he called regular harassment by Cameroon's military, which he says asked them to pay up to $500 per truck as overloading charges when they do not have any weighing instruments. He says their trucks have been grounded because of this.
We are here for 1 week, standing here. Stress. 18 people are locked in the cell. Because when this thing happened on Wednesday last week, we were here till Friday. On Monday, our union president, all of us gathered here in Manfi. We went to the GO's office. We were singing song. We need peace. We need peace. Release our trucks. Release our trucks. The gendarmes now came and took our president. All of us, they carry everybody to the cell.
But Peter Tiende, the most senior government official in Manyu in southwestern Cameroon, says the drivers were arrested because they tried to seize his office.
They actually invaded the office with the intention of taking over the office. In fact, they blocked all the ways into my office when I was out for a meeting. That is why some of them were arrested. We had about 50 persons and we asked them to go away. Those who went away were not arrested. Those who remained had the intention of actually obstructing this office from functioning. And that is why they were arrested.
Business has been slowed in the area through which Cameroon supplies Nigeria with food and farm produce, and Nigeria supplies Cameroon with basic commodities and dresses. The $423 million African Development Bank-funded road is 95% complete. Officials in Cameroon authorized its use before it is fully complete because the area was difficult, at times impossible to access without the new road. But drivers, in the absence of weighing stations, overloaded their trucks, and some Cameroon road protection officials collect bribes. Magam Kome, Cameroon's official in charge of roads in the area, says although they do not have weighing stations yet, they are capable of determining which vehicles are overloaded by simply looking at them. He says they intend to save the new road from degrading.
When you see their trucks, the parts of engines are under. Those are the things which are too heavy. Up is only biscuits, mattresses, and so on. When you pay, you must remove the load that is above the carriage before they allow you to continue.
The road is part of the Trans-African Highway, conceived 30 years ago as a transcontinental link from Lagos, Nigeria, on the Atlantic Ocean to Mombasa, Kenya, on the Indian Ocean. The highway will eventually stretch 6,300 kilometers. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
Pope Francis is to begin his first official visit to Africa Wednesday in Kenya. He's expected to address climate change, inter-religious and inter-ethnic peace and poverty. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Streets are being paved, banners have been hung by the highways, and Pope Francis branded merchandise is for sale. All to welcome the pontiff when he kicks off his Africa tour in Kenya. Kennedy Agesa is a tailor living in the Nairobi slum of Kangemi.
We heard the rumors Pope is coming. We are very happy.
Pope Francis will be visiting Kangemi during his visit. Advocating for the poor has been a key tenet of his papacy. In his native Argentina, he was referred to as a bishop of the slums. Father Simon Peter Kemomoy is a priest at Nairobi's Holy Family Minor Basilica. He says the Pope is the right person to speak about poverty.
Many Kenyans, a good number of Kenyans, are going through difficulties. And so when they see the Holy Father now living a very simple life, you know, he is now identifying with the poor, with the people who are suffering.
Pope Francis is scheduled to speak with young Kenyans during his trip. And if this visit is like previous ones, he will likely urge them to work together, dream big, and above all, have hope. Kangemi resident Luke Kariuki thinks this message will resonate with young people here. He says some youths will be welcome to the church. Some will change their lifestyles. Those who have been abusing drugs, they will change. The Pope is expected to address climate change, having previously said the underprivileged are disproportionately affected. Catholic Relief Services, Kenya and Somalia country representative Lane Bunkers, says climate change is particularly harmful to those whose livelihoods are dependent upon agriculture.
When the weather patterns change significantly, where we have these extreme seasons of drought or seasons of heavy rains, this has an impact on the smallholder farmer.
Pope Francis is also to meet with different faith leaders, an important gesture in a country that has experienced its share of interreligious and interethnic violence.
Because the Pope addresses humanity, you know, not just the Christians.
But along the way, Pope Francis may find that he picks up a few new converts, like Kennedy Agesa, who says he is currently a pagan.
Maybe when I see him, I'll change.
The Pope spends 3 days in Kenya before leaving for his next destination, Uganda. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
A panel of health experts say the World Health Organization's slow response to the Ebola crisis was an egregious failure. It says major reform of the Global Health Agency is urgently needed. The panel, led by former UNAIDS chief Dr. Peter Piot, released its findings today. It calls for the creation of a unified WHO with clear responsibility, adequate capacity, strong lines of accountability, transparency, and responsibility for declaring emergencies. The proposed reforms include improved capacity to handle diseases outbreaks, increased incentives for reporting outbreaks, and careful scientific study of the value of trade and travel restrictions during an outbreak. Liberian panel member Mosako Fala called the WHO response to the Ebola epidemic late, feeble, and uncoordinated. The panel was convened by Harvard University's Global Health Initiative and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The Ebola epidemic killed at least 11,300 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia since it began in December 2013. Meanwhile, more than 2 months after Liberia was declared Ebola-free, three people have been tested positive for the virus in a Monrovia suburb. Local health officials are monitoring 153 people who may have been in contact with the infected patients, a teenage boy and two members of his family. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next, on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis travels to Africa, making his first trip to the continent. The pontiff will visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a pilgrimage that will bring him face to face with Islamic extremism and Christian-Muslim violence. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of the Pope's mission next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Anti-terrorism raids have resulted in 5 more arrests, bringing the total to 21, as Belgium's capital Brussels remains on the highest level of alert. And Mali began 3 days of mourning today to remember those who died in last Friday's terrorist attack. And a panel of health experts say the World Health Organization's slow response to the Ebola crisis was an egregious failure. Coming up, music from Ivory Coast, and in our feature segment, young people from around the world focus on their role in the fight against climate change. I'm Yehudis Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for an Ethiopian star.
Yehias, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Haile Gebrselassie, who says he ran his final competitive race Sunday in the 15th annual Great Ethiopian Run in Addis Ababa. The 2-time Olympic champion, regarded as one of the greatest runners in history, was surrounded by well-wishers both before and after the popular 10-kilometer road race through the Ethiopian capital. Before the race, 42-year-old Haile Gebrselassie said it was a special moment to have a symbolic end to his record-breaking career on home soil.
Yeah, it is. It is, especially here in Ethiopia. It's going to be this one as the last one. Ah, a little bit, you know, just sad. I know, what can I do? It's just over 28 years running. This will be, you know, the last one here in Ethiopia.
Haile Gebrselassie finished the race in about 33 minutes. He says he could have gone faster, but he spent the early part of the race zigging and zagging through the huge crowd of runners. More than 40,000 people participated in the Great Ethiopian Run, which organizers describe as Africa's biggest road race. Haile crossed the line barefoot in honor of another 2-time Olympic champion from Ethiopia, the late Abebe Bikila, who was most famous for winning a marathon gold medal in the 1960 Rome Olympics while running barefoot. After finishing, Haile gave some special thanks.
I would like to say thank you all the people who supporting me the last 28 years, especially my wife and the children and the people of Ethiopia and the whole.
Haile Gebrselassie is one of the founders of the Great Ethiopian Run. He fired the starter's pistol to get the runners going and then joined in with the masses to run. Ethiopian athletes Temirat Tola and Mamitu Daska won the men's and women's titles in Addis Ababa. Temirat clocked 28 minutes and 44 seconds, while Mamitu finished in 32 minutes and 16 seconds. Meanwhile, before the race, reporter Skinder Ferru caught up with Haile Gebrselassie's longtime Dutch manager.
Hello, I'm Jos Hermans. I'm based and I'm living in the Netherlands. I met Haile Gebrselassie when he was 17 years old in 1991 at Jameda Cross Country. And since then, we worked together as a manager, coach, friend, and we will be friends forever.
Let me take you back to that Jameda event. What happened then?
It was a cross country in it was a selection race, and he became fifth in that race. He didn't win, but because of that selection race,
he was 10 kilometers.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, around 10k, because he was still junior. Can be also 8 kilometers. He was he was then selected for the World Cross Champions Juniors 1 or 2 months later in Belgium in Antwerp. And he competed there. I'm quite sure he was number 7 then in the World Championships cross country in Antwerp, and then in 1992 he was second in the World Championships cross country in juniors in Boston. And anyway, since that date in February 1991, we worked together.
In Janmeda, what were you doing at that time? Were you recruiting, you know, athletes? Tell me how you approached him first.
Okay. No, I came already in 1982 for the first time to Ethiopia, and then I was scouting athletes for the Rotterdam Marathon. I was the organizer of Rotterdam Marathon, so I scouted.
You were scouting Balena Densamo in that.
Yes, and McConnell and all the other athletes. And then I came more often to Ethiopia. And Ethiopia has a special place in my heart already from the days of Abebe Bikila. You know, when I saw the movie from the Olympics in 1960 and 64, I was a young boy, 10 years, 14 years, and you know, somebody from a very, very far away country, barefoot, winning the Olympics in Rome, and it was for me like an incredible story. And since then, I always liked to go to Ethiopia. And so in 1982, I came, and then I came more and more often. And I was many times every year at the Yameda for the cross country. And then in 1991, I saw Haile and a few other athletes, and I made contact with them and asked them if I could represent them. And that's how we started to work together.
Mm-hmm. So you represented him for how many years as his manager?
Yeah, from the beginning, 1991, for today or this year is 24 years.
What is the most unforgettable moment in Haile's athletics life for you, especially?
Oh, there's too many unforgettable moments, fantastic moments of winning races, his first world record in the 5,000 meters in Hengelo in my country. Then another one, he broke the world record 5,000 meters in Zurich with 11 seconds, amazingly. It's nearly 1 second per lap. Of course, everybody talks about 2000 Olympics in Sydney where he won from Paul Thacker. The amazing thing about that performance is that he was injured already several months. He was not training completely. Actually, we had already an appointment in Finland to go to a doctor to have an operation for his tendon. He still decided to go to run for his country, and he was winning that race not only on his talents as a runner, but also especially on how strong his mind was. And another fantastic race for me was when he was breaking the world record in the marathon in 2:03:59.
Are you surprised that he decided to stop running at this time?
Yes and no. Yes, it's time because he gets older. It's more difficult. The body is not that young anymore. No, because he loves running. He will run forever. And it was always difficult to pin him down. We have to pin him down about saying goodbye many times. We talked already about it maybe 5 years ago, 7 years ago. And he could never say, you know, when do I want to stop? He highly chooses his own moments. And he has a few times, he has already said before, one time in New York.
In New York, yeah.
One time in New York, and then this year again in Manchester. You know, that's spontaneous. It comes from himself. It was never discussed between him and myself. And now, you know, of course, it's fantastic if he can run in Addis Ababa for, you know, hundreds of thousands of people to watch him and enjoy and, you know, say farewell. But I'm sure many people here in Addis Ababa and Ethiopia will still see him running early morning in the woods outside Addis Ababa. So in that way, he will never stop.
How many Ethiopian athletes do you represent now?
I don't count, but there's many. I mean, probably at least 50 or 60 Ethiopian athletes we are working with. It's not only me. We have a big office in Holland. Mm-hmm. We work with 30 people. We have very good coaches. Ketana Tesema is one of our coaches here. Valentine Trau, he's one of the persons in our office who's also here now that works with many of the athletes. And we have a wonderful group of athletes, young athletes also. So it's hard work, but it's also a big pleasure.
That's Jos Hermans, the longtime Dutch manager of Ethiopian star Haile Gebrselassie. And Jos was talking with reporter Skinder Farou in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Hello, this is Haile Gebrselassie. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sport on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
The Sunny Side of Sports remembers three-time Olympic champion Marvelous Mal Whitfield of the United States, who died here in Washington at age 91. He had heart disease and prostate cancer, according to his daughter, Frederica Whitfield, who works as a news anchor for CNN Television. Her father won two gold medals at the 1948 London Olympics in the 800 meters and 4x400 meters relay, and another gold in the 800 meters at the 1952 Helsinki Olympics. But Whitfield's biggest legacy was off the track. After his athletics career, Mal worked for nearly 50 years as a sports ambassador in Africa for the U.S. government. Mal conducted sports clinics all over the continent, coached young athletes, and yes, was a marvelous goodwill ambassador who used his Olympic success to better the lives of young Africans. Whitfield was also a member of the acclaimed African-American military unit in World War II, known as the Tuskegee Airmen. He served as an Air Force sergeant during the Korean War and went on more than 25 bombing missions as a tail gunner. Mal trained for the Olympics by running on an airfield between military assignments. Olympic champion, sports goodwill ambassador, and Air Force veteran Mal Whitfield, dead at the age of 91. In National Basketball Association news, the defending champion Golden State Warriors have tied the best start in NBA history. The Warriors beat the host Denver Nuggets 118-105 on Sunday night to move to 15 wins without a loss. Klay Thompson scored 21 points for Golden State. The Warriors matched the start of the 1948-49 Washington Capitals and the 1993-94 Houston Rockets. Some of our VOA basketball fans might remember that Rockets club featured Akeem the Dream Olajuwon, arguably the greatest basketball player ever from African soil. The Golden State Warriors can break the record Tuesday night at home when they host Kobe Bryant and the Los Angeles Lakers. The Warriors going after their 16th win in a row to start the NBA season red hot. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahayis Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, young people from around the world focus on their role in the fight against climate change. And next, 2016, we can expect continued advances towards a world with even more smart devices. But first, some music. Here is by Carme Takari from Ivory Coast with Woody T.
Mutuake, Manyo Kasu, Awolo Chemia, Elale, Kudu.
Ivory Coast, Bikarme Takari with Woody T. Hundreds of young people from around the world who recently gathered at the World Bank in Washington to focus on their role in the fight against climate change as world leaders prepare to meet in France later this month for the annual UN meeting on the subject. VOA's Makayama Diallo reports from Washington.
Rachel Kite is the World Bank's Group Vice President and Special Envoy for Climate Change. She told the crowd of young people their actions make a difference.
One of us, and then two of us, then five of us, then ten of us, all deciding to demand a different action at the state, local, city, country level makes a difference. That the Purchasing decisions we make in terms of food make a difference. Purchasing decisions we make in terms of electricity make a difference. This might seem like a global existential threat, but it's actually about the footprint that we all put on the planet and the way in which our governments represent the way that I think young people think about this.
Kite says that most survey data show that people understand the world has to reduce the amount of carbon pollution in the atmosphere in order to be able to have better oceans, fields, foods, and safe water, but acknowledges there are skeptics. There's widespread conservative opposition in the United States to a binding agreement on pollution standards to limit greenhouse gases.
In this country, for all kinds of reasons, it's become a partisan issue, and there is a lot of misinformation out there. But, you know, the farmers of California, the farmers of Colorado, the farmers of the Dakotas in the Midwest, the people of the Great Lakes, the people of Staten Island and Florida and North Carolina and Maine, and the people of Galveston, Texas, all understand that the natural disasters and the weather patterns that they're seeing shift are coming from something which isn't just sporadic.
Participant Radhima Yadav is an undergraduate student at Yale University. She's been involved with the UN climate talks as a youth delegate for the past 5 years. She says the key issue that many political leaders seem to miss is that climate change is interconnected to every other issue in a political agenda.
I think you have to shape the narrative not as climate change being some catastrophe or an apocalyptic scenario, which can immediately put off people. You need to make it more relatable to their daily lives. Make it about gender. Make it about education. Make it about employment, water. Make it about issues which affect our daily lives.
A participant from Uganda, Derek Opia Hosea, the founder of One Lamp Express, is already affecting daily lives. He said 85% of the people in his country use kerosene lamps because they don't have access to the grid, but about 80% of the same people have access to mobile phones.
We enable every person with a mobile phone to go ahead and order for a solar light product and then pay for that solar light product using, of course, mobile money, which has already taken off, and then we deliver to their doorstep.
He says his company has sold about 4,000 solar lights and have reached more than 12,000 homes, therefore reducing the amount of carbon emissions from kerosene lamps. Youth Summit Chair Ines Gonzalez Del Mazo says the two-day event includes a competition for youth-driven ideas to reduce climate change. From 330 proposals received from more than 70 countries, 6 teams of finalists will pitch their ideas to a jury of experts, and the winners will be sent to New York's International Council of Small Businesses Annual Academy for training and mentorship. Gonzalez Del Mazo says she hopes their ideas can be turned into businesses or help shape policies. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The Consumer Electronics Show, held each January in Las Vegas, is considered to be the most important display of everyday technologies expected to hit the market during the rest of the year. Judging by the sneak preview held recently in New York, consumers in 2016 can expect continued advances towards a world with even more smart devices. VOA's George Puttick reports.
High-definition cameras, sensors, electric motors, and remote controls have become so small and cheap they can be put on most everyday objects. Using the processing power of our smartphones, they become, well, robotic.
Slowly, slowly, we're going to see more robots in our life. They're not going to look like actual robots. It's going to be robotic technology that's applied to other appliances or devices, which are going to make our lives much easier.
A smart ball called Sensor Sphere can easily serve as a remote sentry, checking if everything's fine when you're away from home.
And you can drive it around from one room to another, and it can stream live video, audio, temperature, humidity information, and even smoke information if there is a fire in your home.
The sensors are so tiny that there's room for more. For instance, a thermal imaging camera which can look for survivors in closed, tight spaces such as collapsed buildings. Sports equipment manufacturer Adidas presented a soccer ball that will provide coaches and fans with exciting information.
The soccer ball actually has
inside of it a triaxial accelerometer and some sensors that's able to pick up on the speed, the flight path, the rotation or the spin, and kind of give an almost instantaneous feedback through the companion app how you did with your kick.
The smart ball called My Coach Smart Soccer is already available online for about $200. Another smart device called Sculpit Chisel can measure up to 24 individual muscles in human body.
It's the first device that lets you measure your fat content and your muscle quality, so you can see how much fat you're losing, how much muscle you're gaining, how you're getting stronger.
Virtual reality is also getting more affordable as well as mobile. A simple device called Wear Reality can turn any smartphone into virtual reality goggles.
We're seeing the phones doubling in performance every year. So what you're going to see is all this technology is going to be mobile and something you carry around with you.
And this is only a preview of what we can expect to see at the world's biggest consumer electronics show early January in Las Vegas. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Xiaogun Chang, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, at the very beginning of a new millennium, the world faces what Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken called a threat that does not stop at borders and does not distinguish among its victims. In every corner of the globe, in every country represented here today in ways big and small, violent extremists have left their mark, murdering, terrorizing, and preaching an ideology of nihilism and fear that seeks to defy humanity. These remarks came at a high-level event on preventing violent extremism through education, organized by the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, and the permanent mission of the United States during the 38th General Conference at UNESCO headquarters. Deputy Secretary Blinken added, "Our weapon of choice in this fight is a weapon surpassing any that extremists possess, one that delivers a blow that no agent of hate or intolerance can withstand. It is the bright light of education." In the words of UNESCO Director General Irina Bokova, "Violent extremists offer destruction and hatred. We must respond with culture and knowledge. Violent extremists promote fear and division. We must respond with skills for critical thinking, with opportunities for civic engagement, with competences for dialogue across cultures." UNESCO has a program available to ministries that request it called Global Citizenship Education. It helps create a learning environment that promotes a free exchange of ideas. The hope is to raise a generation of responsible global citizens by instilling in students a respect for human rights, social justice, diversity, gender equality, and environmental sustainability. Building on this program, the United States will take the next step and help develop a digital education resource to prevent and undermine the allure of violent extremism. By arming young minds with a world perspective rooted in respect, social justice, diversity, and critical thinking, we can counter radicalization as it arises and even prevent its growth in the first place, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. By investing in their future, we secure ours. The alternative is too tragic to even contemplate. Without a quality education, these children are in danger of being exploited, forced to work, pressured into early marriage, conscripted as child soldiers, or become prey to the siren song of violent extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, high heels and women. Is it a symbol of beauty? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing high heels and women. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.